I'll start with how I first met Srila Prabhupada. I was, of course, I could begin this story at different stages, but I will begin when I was in the university, at Brandeis University near Boston. And I was looking for perfect happiness, and I had already concluded that I could not achieve perfect happiness in the material realm, that it could be available only in a non-material realm. And after some time, I understood that to be successful, I needed a guru. And then my focus became how to find my guru. And at the time, there were many from India who had come to America, and I was going to meet them. Fortunately, the university that I was attending, I ended up in the Department of Psychology, and the head of the department was named Abraham Maslow, and he began or developed what he considered to be the third force in psychology. Up until then, there were two main forces. One was behaviorism, which studied stimulus and response behavior. And their main subjects were rats. And then the other main school was psychoanalysis, founded by Sigmund Freud. And so what Professor Maslow said was that, okay, we have one school, they study rats, or just behavior, not consciousness. And then another that studies diseased people. So there should be a force that studies healthy people. And so he developed a whole theory. So the whole department was influenced with this sort of alternative view of psychology. And they invited many swamis and yogis and masters. And then apart from the ones that came to the campus, I was going out looking because I was just determined that I must find a guru. So one of the ones who came to the campus was, I won't give the names, it's not necessary. So he was a yogi, and he gave a lecture in which he said that by yoga you could gain mastery of your involuntary muscles. And he said that by yoga you can command your intestines, I forget the names, but like, I guess ascending, colon, advance, and then your stuff goes up, then transverse colon advance, then it goes across, then descending colon advance, and then it goes down, and then rectum release, and then it comes out. So I thought, hello, this is very interesting, but what does this have to do with eternal happiness, you know, with perfect happiness? So I thought, anyway, let me meet the Swami and speak with him. So he was visiting from New York, and I asked if I could ride in the car with him to the airport. But his people said, no, his car is full, but you can ride with some of his disciples to the airport. So I got in the car with them, and the main topic they were discussing on the way was all the different kinds of food they missed since they joined the ashram. And I thought, this doesn't seem right. You know, they were just with their guru, and all they're thinking about is the food they're missing. I thought, anyway, they're just the students. We can't judge just by the students. So we got to the airport, and he was really the picture of Indian spirituality. He had long, flowing hair and flowing robes and a twinkle in his eyes and a grin on his face. And I saw him very warmly, tightly embracing a lady admirer. And I thought, he's not my perfect master. So then another one who came to the campus, quite well known, and he was giving two sessions, a morning session and an afternoon session, with a break in between. So I went to one of my psychology professors. They were inviting all of these Swamis and yogis, actually. And I said, I want to meet the guru during the break. And he said, why do you want to meet him? I said, well, I want to see, maybe he can be my guru. I'm looking for a guru. And he said, oh, he doesn't accept disciples. He doesn't even touch money. So I thought, well, that doesn't sound right. You know, if he has knowledge and he can help people, why should he refuse just to be renounced? So I thought, no, he's not my perfect master. Then, there are many. But I'll skip ahead because we can't discuss them all, but I can tell you that there were many. So then I heard that an enlightened Zen master, certified to be enlightened by another certified enlightened Zen master from Japan. And he was having a weekend introduction at his ashram in Rochester. And I read it. He wrote a book, quite a well-known book, The Three Pillars of Zen, which I had read. So I went to his ashram. And, you know, the students opened the door. They all seemed sort of morose. But again, I thought, well, they're just the students. We can't really judge based on the students. So he had us, eventually, you know, he had us in a room, sitting up straight, looking at the wall, and he gave us something to meditate on, like a koan, a riddle. And he would go around the room with a stick. And if he thought someone's mind was wandering, he would give them a, he would strike them with the stick. And so, you know, he was walking around, and I was trying to meditate on the riddle, but frankly, I was afraid that he was going to come and hit me with the stick. So I thought, anyway, I was trying. I was desperate. I mean, I was trying. So then there was a lunch break, and they had these, I think it turns out it's sort of typical of Buddhist places, but like these wood benches and wood tables, very basic and simple. And so one of his students was sort of criticizing him or chiding him for having gotten angry. Mm-hmm. And he said, yes, I shouldn't have lost my temper like that. So I had some doubt. But then I'd also read that enlightened Zen masters appear to be ordinary. So I thought, well, maybe this is part of it. He's just, like, appears to be ordinary. Mm-hmm. So I didn't completely, you could say, strike him off the list, but I wasn't convinced. So then I went back to Boston, and then I heard there was another enlightened soul who was a professor of psychology at Antioch University in Ohio. So I drove there, you know, I went on a Friday after my last class on Thursday. And, you know, great expectations, went to his office and met his secretary, and I said, where is so-and-so? So she said, he's playing golf. So I didn't say it, but she must have read it from my facial expression. I was thinking, playing golf? Why is he playing golf? And without my saying anything, she said, that's his Zen. I thought, oh, man. So I thought, I'm not going to pursue him. But I'd driven all that way, so I went to the student union. And there I met some people who were students talking about a swami who had recently been to the campus. I still don't know who he is. The end of his name was Ananda, but there are many swamis. But they said that he had told them that the guru is in your heart. He's on the lotus of your heart. And you can speak with him. And this completely captured my imagination. It was the first time in all of my searches that I'd heard of a personal conception of God. Up until then, it was all impersonal, whether Hindu or, you know, Zen Buddhist or whatever. And so I had that in my mind, and I was thinking, wow, you know, like I was sort of imagining, like, or concentrating on my heart, and that the guru is situated on the lotus of your heart. I thought, wow, this is very interesting, but I didn't know where to go with it. So I went back to Brandeis. There was there was a meeting at MIT, Houston Smith, and he had invited the same Zen master. So someone asked him about Vedanta. And he said, I have enough trouble keeping up with Zen. Why are you asking me about Vedanta? I thought, he's not my perfect master. So, by this point, I was almost hopeless. I was basically hopeless, because I had gone to so many, I had driven thousands of miles, and I wasn't finding my perfect master. And somehow I'd gotten the idea from reading that your guru is already there. That you don't have to choose him, but you just have to find him. And I even had a mental impression of what he looked like. Just a very dim, vague impression. And he didn't have hair. And all the other swamis and yogis had long hair. So that made me even more hopeless. So, one night I invited a few friends over to my apartment for dinner. I was already a vegetarian by then. And it was planned that after dinner we would go to Harvard Square an art house, what they used to call art houses. It was like a movie theater. And it showed art films, you know, artistic films. And this was a from Japan. And so we were going to go to the movie. But I had seen on campus a poster lecture, Bhagavad Gita as it is, you know, A.C. Bhaktivedanta Swami. But I was like so discouraged by then, I thought, you know, it's just going to be like another one, probably, and it's just too discouraging. So after we finished our dinner, you know, that poster came in my mind. And there was something in my heart that was telling me, you must go. You must go to this. So I brought it up to my friends, and they said, well, we already have another program. Well, yeah, that's true. All right. But that was an agreeable type. I didn't want to, like, disappoint them. But something in my heart, it was just pushing me, you know, that you must go. I said, you know, I think I really want to go to that lecture. And we can go to the late show of the movie, and first we can go to the lecture. So, you know, they were grumbling, but, you know, weren't too upset. But there was like one lady friend, and she was very upset. She was very upset, and she got, you know, very angry, and she said, you know, why do you have to be chasing after all these swamis and yogis? You know, why can't you be normal like other people? And she was like really shouting. But by then I was like being controlled, you know, that I had to go to this. So, why do you have to be chasing after all these? So I said, all right, this will be the last one I ever go to. So, then we went. We were late because of all the discussion. But we went into the auditorium. And they were just beginning the last kirtana, I understood. And so students, it's amazing, like one by one, students from the audience were getting up out of their seats and climbing up onto the stage and joining the kirtana, like dancing in a circle. And the auditorium, it had bare brick walls inside. It's sort of like a modern, well, I mean, it was okay, I guess, but the sound was just reverberating. It was just amazing. And I felt like jumping up on the stage and dancing with the devotees. But I was like, I was sort of like the leader of my group of friends. And so like there's a few on one side and a few on the other. And I thought, you know, if I do this, it'll probably be the end. You know, this will probably be the straw that breaks the camel's back. So I just stood up and, you know, danced in place. Then after the lecture, a devotee asked if anyone was driving to Boston or to Cambridge. They should meet the devotees in the lobby because the devotees need a lift. They didn't have any motor vehicle then. So we were going to Harvard Square. So I went out to the lobby, and the first devotee I met was Bharadraj. He's actually the first devotee I ever spoke to personally. And so I told him, and so I had a red Rambler station wagon. Do you have station wagons now? It's like it's like an SUV, but not exactly an SUV. But it had like a compartment in the back, like the front seat and the passenger. And so they all piled in, and there was a lady devotee in the front seat named Janava. And, you know, I had all these things on my mind from my spiritual quest. So I brought up Yogananda, because I read a book by him called Autobiography of a Yogi. He said, "Oh, Yogananda, have you ever been to his ashram in California? He has a monument to Mahatma Gandhi as a worker for world peace." He wasn't a worker for world peace. He was working for India's political independence. He doesn't even know who Gandhi is. And then she said, "He's just a shopkeeper. You know, if you want Shiva, he has Shiva in stock. If you want Durga, he has Durga. You know, if you want yoga, he's just a shopkeeper." I thought, wow, he's like pretty strong. And then I brought up about Zen. And she said that this phenomenal world is like, it's like a movie image on a screen. It looks like it's real, but it's not actually real. And if you draw your attention back from the images on the screen, you'll see there's a beam of light. And if you follow your attention further back, you'll see it comes to a point. But behind that point, there's a whole machine projecting it. And behind the machine, there's a person, a projectionist, who's running the machine. And I thought, wow, this is amazing. This is the best explanation I've ever heard of Zen. And it goes beyond it. And I thought, this young lady is remarkable. But I thought, this all can't be coming from her, you know? It must be coming from someone, you know, above her. It must be coming from her guru. So that made me really eager to meet the Guru. So we got to Harvard Square, and I let the devotees out of the car. And then I realized I didn't have the address to the temple. I didn't know how to meet them. So I parked the car and just ran after the devotees. And every devotee was like a wise man. So the devotee who I caught up to first, he was, I guess, walking the slowest, was named Petit Pavan. And he used to live in, maybe still does, Union City or somewhere in the area. Anyway, his wife is connected to the Berkeley Temple. So he said, "You see all these people? They're just like sleepwalkers. They don't know who they are. They don't know where they're going." And I was just like fascinated. And then suddenly I heard like this honking of horns like penetrated my consciousness. I realized, oh my God, I left the car in the turnabout. All the cars are backing up. They can't. So I said, "Quick, give me the address." So the next night I went to the temple, and Srila Prabhupada was speaking, and I couldn't understand his accent that well, and also I wasn't used to the philosophy. But I did catch him saying that, you know, out of many thousands of men, one will seek perfection. And I thought, that's me. He's talking about me. And then at the end of the talk, I asked my question. There are so many swamis and yogis, and each one says his method is the best. So how do I know which is the best? And he replied very intelligently, "What is your goal?" And I was asking, what is the best means? But, you know, the means to what end? So you're saying, what is your goal? Do you want to serve God, or do you want to become God? Yeah. And then he said, if you want to become God, it means you're not God now. And how can not God become God? And he said, God is God. He's always God. He doesn't have to become God by yoga or meditation. He said, Krishna is God. He's God when he's playing on the lap of Mother Yashoda. He's God when he's speaking the Bhagavad Gita to Arjuna. He's always God. He doesn't have to become God. And then he said, you can become godly, but you cannot become God. He said, God is in your heart. It's like what that other song said. That God is in your heart. And he is there to help you. He said, if you water the seed of service to God, no, sorry, if you plant the seed of service to God and water it by chanting and hearing, then God will provide the sunlight and fresh air and all the conditions to make it favorable. But if you want to become God, then you're only cheating yourself. Because why should God help the competition? So now at that time, I had the distinct impression that Srila Prabhupada was seeing like straight through me, through the walls of the temple, down the roads to my apartment, into my apartment, into my bathroom, to the wall of my bathroom. where I had written in very ornate letters in different colors in my own hand, a sign. And I felt he was looking right at that sign. And that sign said, "You are God." In case I forgot, I had to remind myself. So then I was convinced. I found my perfect master. So he said, "So what do you think? You want to serve God or you want to become God?" So by then I understood, so I said, "I want to serve God." But I also realized I couldn't teach Srila Prabhupada. He already knew everything. So I said, "I want to serve God, but I realized actually I wanted to become God." He said, "Yes." So then that was it. I found my perfect master. I bowed down my head in obeisance and surrender, and that was the beginning. I mean, many interesting things happened that night and thereafter, but that was how I found my perfect master. And just to skip ahead quite a bit, skipping over quite a bit, but after, this was in, say, April of 69, and then in October of 70, Srila Prabhupada wanted to return to India and begin the activities there. And he wanted, like, the best person from each temple who could be spared. So I was, like, the number two person in the Boston temple. And so I went with Srila Prabhupada. And so many things happened. I mean, I felt very at home in India, very at home. And you know, someone asked about Juhu, the history of Juhu, and it's a whole story, but I'll just tell one incident, which was very dramatic. And in fact, one of the gentlemen who walked in a little late, had a mustache, him, exactly. Huh? Yeah, he looks very much like the hero or one of the heroes of this, story. Yeah, that man's name was Mr. Sethi. He was a Punjabi. So what happened, really in brief, is that this Mr. Nair, who he owned this 4-acre parcel of land called Nair Wadi. And he was a very cunning man. Before us, he'd already sold the land to someone else and taken money from him. But he embedded a condition in the agreement that the purchaser couldn't fulfill. And he could do that because he said he was the owner. Later we found out from the real owners that he wasn't really the owner, but he presented himself as the owner of the Free Press Journal, which is one of three English daily newspapers. They're very influential. He'd been the sheriff of Bombay, a very wealthy person. And he had influence in all the different departments. So he could make sure that the purchaser couldn't fulfill the conditions. And then he would cancel the agreement and keep the money and, you know. So we were the next in line. He did the same thing with us. And so, but it's like Srila Prabhupada, there's a saying, you know, possession is 9/10 of the law. Like if you have possession, that really makes your position strong. And Srila Prabhupada, maybe he foresaw there might be some difficulties, so like according to the agreement, once we paid a certain amount, we could build on the land. So he built a little shed, temple, more like a shed, for the deities, Radharasa Vihari. And so the main thing, and anyway, they were getting offers, I guess, for much bigger amounts for the land. And anyway, to come to the point, they arranged, Mrs. Nair arranged for the temple to be demolished. It was horrible. I mean, big truckload of municipal demolition workers came, and then they were supported by a big van from the police. And so they started to dismantle the temple. And one by one, as we came forward, they would just pick us up and put us in the van, the police van. And there was one lady, Maithili, and she was the head pujari. She was like quite a heavy set woman, and she stationed herself in front of the deity doors. And, you know, she was a woman, and she was like, if anyone came near, she would like kick, and she wouldn't. And then eventually they had some women constables come, and I think they grabbed her by the hair, and they took her away to put her in the police truck. And she comments sometimes that that's how she's going to go back to Godhead, kicking and screaming. So, anyway, one person didn't come forward. You know, we were all coming forward and being apprehended by the police. One person didn't come forward. He was like hiding in the bushes looking. And somehow he got the idea to phone one of our friends, life members, friends, and that person had connections with Mal Thackeray from Chief Sena. And Mal Thackeray, he phoned the municipal commissioner. And he said, you know, your people are dismantling this temple, Hindu temple. And the police commissioner said falsely, because we did have permission, but he said false, because you know how it is. We heard also that money had been paid all over, and that's how you get certain types of things done. So he said, they don't have permission. And then Mala Sahib said, don't forget who this city belongs to. Okay, Balasab. So then he got word to the K ward office, and the ward officer himself came running, you know, to stop the demolition. And they had just started to remove some of the roof over the deities. The Darshan Mandap, like the Kirtan Hall, and that was like, you know, the roof, everything was totally. And they were just starting on the deities, and the order to stop came. So we came back, from the police station. And, so anyway, then there was like a campaign to get permission to rebuild the temple. And it was good in a way. You know, we were meeting all the representatives to the municipal corporation and, you know, trying to get a lot of support. Then one day, we realized, I think it was a Thursday, actually, you don't need permission to rebuild it. Because we already had the permission. They're the ones who demolished it without authority. So we don't need permission. We can just rebuild it. And Mrs. Nair, I don't know what kind of network of spies she had. Somehow she heard that we're going to rebuild it. So she went to the court to get an injunction to prevent us from rebuilding it. And they have these permanent injunctions, interim injunctions, ad interim injunctions. So she asked, well, at least a temporary injunction. So the justice, High Court Justice 9, he said, no, I will not give, injunction. He will give at least a temporary injunction. He said, I won't give an injunction until I hear the other side. At least give a temporary injunction until Monday, and then you can hear the other side. He said, no, I'm not giving any injunction without hearing the other side. So then we knew we had till Monday, because once it was rebuilt, the injunction would have no meaning. So it was very difficult because, first of all, it was the weekend. Second of all, there was cement control. I mean, there's such a problem to get materials. And so this man, could you stand up once more? He looks so much like Mr. Sethi. So it'll help you to visualize it. So Mr. Sethi, he was a contractor, and as I mentioned, he's a Punjabi, was sort of a Kshatriya type. And so he, somehow between him and other friends, we got all the materials. And on Sunday, they were going to rebuild the temple. And that day it was raining. So heavily. So that made it even harder, but still, Mr. Sethi was determined. And so Mr. Nair, he had this friend in the municipal corporation named Matre. So he came and he said, You can rebuild the temple, but I'm going to come with 50 gundas in the night and tear it down. And Mr. Sethi, he had his son with him, Bridge Mohan. He said, Bridge Mohan, bring my rifle and my revolver. And then he said to Matre, bring 50 people, bring 100, bring 200. I have 250 cartridges. And so he went away. But then and he did it. He had his gun, and his son was there with a revolver. And around 11 o'clock at night, someone came. I think he had a group with him. But this one man, he came ahead, and he came onto the property and he looked. And he saw Mr. Sethi with his gun. And Mr. Sethi said, you want something? He said, no. So then he left. And then Mr. Sethi could hear him tell the others, they're prepared.
we have to leave this place. So meanwhile, Tamal Krishna Goswami was the GBC. I was the temple president. So he wanted me to stay up all night. And I'm not sure completely what was in my mind, because I knew I'd have to go to court the next day and everything, or maybe I just didn't want to stay up all night. So somehow, Satsarupa Maharaj had just been to Bombay, and he always seemed like so humble. I mean, he was very humble and gentle. And I don't know, I said something like, you know, I just want to be humble like Satsarupa Maharaj. And Tamal Krishna Goswami looked at me and he said, your humility will be to stay up all night and make sure this temple gets rebuilt. And I thought about it and I thought, he's right. You know, where's the humility? You know, humility means I should be ready to do whatever, surrender to whatever service is required, whatever the spiritual master wants of. And then another of those early devotees, his Holiness Sridhar Swami, he was like a tough type of person. A very, very tough type of person. And in fact, he first met the devotees in Berkeley. They had, they were doing kirtan, had a book table on Telegraph Avenue. And so he was, as I mentioned, a very tough fellow. And he went up to the book table and there's books, there's posters. So he said to the devotee there, who's this? It was Krishna. He said, this is God. So Sridhar Swami, he wasn't Sridhar Swami then, but he said, what would you do if I tore up that picture of Krishna? The devotee said, I think I'd have to kill you. And Sridhar Swami thought, okay, these are my kind of people. I can fit in here. So Sridhar Swami, he thought, okay, there could be a fight. So he was ready. So at that time, it was quite a while in India also before we had any vehicles, but by that time we did have three jeeps. And so he was sitting in one of the jeeps, chanting japa. Ready. If there's a fight, there's a fight. He'll be prepared. And one of maybe Mr. Seti's son went up to him. It was like really raining heavily, as I mentioned. He said, "What are you doing? What are you doing here in the jeep?" He said, "I'm waiting in case there's any trouble. I can run away very fast." He was joking, of course. He was ready, but nothing happened. So then the next day, we went to court, and we brought photos how the temple had been rebuilt, and then the high court judge said, what's done is done. The temple is there, and it cannot be touched. No. So that was one incident. So maybe that's all for Juhu. I mean, for now. But yes, about the book. So eventually Mrs. Nair, her husband died. That was another incident. But the land was in her name from the beginning. But she had like a change of heart. She surrendered to Prabhupada. She said, I never agreed with what my husband was doing. And she was like very upset. And, you know, I think Mr. Sethi met her, and this was when it was going to be signed over, and he conveyed what she had said to Srila Prabhupada, and Srila Prabhupada said, it's all right. It's like, in the morning, if you stray off the path, but then in the afternoon, if you come back to the path, you're not lost. You'll find your way home. And tell her she's my daughter, and I will protect her. And it was really very sweet. And then there was, so she signed the documents, and she was weeping. Prabhupada signed, and the registrar came out to Juhu, and there was a big feast, and then afterwards, Srila Prabhupada leaned back on his asana, and he said, it was a good fight. And then he said, someone should write a book about it. So, Hare Krishna. So I know I sort of asked for questions. I tried to weave some of the answers into my narrative. But if there are any specific questions, and the thing about the standards, that's a little, I mean, that's a point, that if something is an official ISKCON temple, we should have a standard. But exactly what that means, it could vary. But I know that I've been very, very wary of, for example, devotees worshipping Lord Shiva on Shivaratri. Because we know, as devotees, Vaishnava Namyata Shampu, Lord Shiva's greatest Vaishnava. But, you know, if people come and they don't really understand, they'll say, oh, I went to ISKCON, and, you know, they worship Lord Shiva, it's okay to worship Lord Shiva, and, you know, and that sort of what Prabhupada called hodgepodge Hindu idea, like they're all gods, all equal, which is an offense. It's an offense against the holy name. So that sort of gets perpetuated. We have to be very careful. When Srila Prabhupada came to Madras, I arranged his program. There are a lot of Shaivites there. And, he dealt with them very tactfully. But there was one very wealthy man. He was like installing a temple in his home. A very wealthy aristocratic man. And he invited a lot of important people, like, business people and also religious figures. And the temple room wasn't that big. So Prabhupada was inside, of course, but we were outside. And so I think the main deity was a Shiva Linga. So anyway, there were the host distributed flower petals, and you know, at the time, people were like offering their flowers to Lord Shiva. And we're like watching, what is Srila Prabhupada going to do? And then he like threw his flower petals in the corner. So then when everyone came out, we went in, and it turned out there was a little murti of Krishna in the corner. So he offered his flowers to Krishna. So I think that's very important that we're exemplary, you know, because what we do, that will be taken as a standard. Oh, in this kind they do this. So, but yeah, as far as initiated and what it, that, you know, they're like details that I'm not aware of. But that's true in principle that we should be exemplary. So anyone who comes, they can learn what is the proper method of worship, of devotional service by our example. And certainly, if someone is going to be worshiping the deity, you know, they should be following the regulative principles and chanting. In principle, they should be second initiated, but I've heard of exceptions for different reasons. In principle, they should be.
So let me ask you one question on this one. This is a good point. So like, when we say somebody can do aparad, or the name of, in some name, but then we also know that Krishna is so merciful.
Yeah.
So then people can think, oh, it doesn't matter. Krishna is merciful. So even if we do it, it's okay. How would you justify that?
Well, it's like a father punishes a child. The father is merciful. The punishment is for the child's benefit. The worst aparad is Vaishnava aparad. Or, you know, Sadhananda, Gurura Bhagya. And so the reactions to that offense are very serious, but that's actually beneficial for the offender to suffer the reactions and then become humble. And then when he becomes humble, he can, you know, beg forgiveness of the Vaishnava and not commit further offenses. Yeah, that's the main one. And we should avoid that one like anything. There's one of my godbrothers, Burijan Das. He sometimes gives japa retreats, you know, japa seminars. And he wrote a book called Japa, a very good book. So in one of the retreats, he gave the class a homework assignment. Because the two main offenses he wanted to be them to be aware of or wary of were Vaishnava aparad, sadhu-ninda, and inattentiveness, pramada. So in the morning, the next morning, he asked them about their homework assignment, whether, you know, they had observed themselves on these two points. So one devotee said that she had gone out with some other devotees and she didn't want to engage in, you know, gossiping about devotees or, you know, finding faults with devotees. But it was in the atmosphere, how she put it. So Burijan Prabhu said, well, you have two choices. One is, you can try to change the atmosphere. And if you want to change the atmosphere, good luck. Because the atmosphere doesn't want to change.
Well, you will.
The atmosphere wants to criticize devotees. And the other is that you know what's right, and you do what's right, and you don't do what's wrong, no matter what's in the atmosphere. And, you know, that's more practical. So, but the reactions we get are beneficial all around. It's beneficial for us. It also protects the devotees from people offending them, because the offenders get reactions, and then, being merciful doesn't necessarily mean being lenient. I'm sure every parent knows this. Sometimes it requires being strict. Any other questions or comments? Yes.
Maharaj, question, like, when you first met Srila Prabhupada, had you familiarized yourself with philosophy? Or, I mean, you kind of knew that he was your guru in the, you know, in the get-go, immediately?
No, I didn't know. All I had been exposed to until then was pretty much impersonal. And so he convinced me on the spot of the philosophy. Yeah. There weren't many books back then. Now we have so many books, but there was just the little purple Bhagavad Gita as it is, abridged edition. And then there was Teachings of Lord Chaitanya. An Easy Journey to Other Planets. And there's there weren't many books back then. Prabhupada himself convinced me. But it is very, I think, important or significant that Srila Prabhupada really wanted his books distributed. Oh, there were the Bhagavatams. Let me not forget. Yes, the first three volumes of the Bhagavatam. That's very important. So he wanted someone to put his books in bookstores. And somehow I was given that assignment in Boston. And I went to many bookstores, and especially there is a big bookstore called the Harvard Coop, really Harvard Co-op, and right at Harvard Square. And they took a huge order. I mean, I myself was surprised. I didn't have that many books, that many copies with me. They took a huge order. And other bookstores also took orders. And when Srila Prabhupada heard, he was very pleased. I think that was like the first time I was recognized for some specific service like that. It was from books. And later I got a letter from a devotee many years later who had gotten one of Prabhupada's books from another bookstore in Harvard Square. Somehow he put things together and figured out I was the one who put that book in that bookstore. And he got that book, and that book, he became a devotee from that book. So, yeah, that's really good. Yeah, I've been reading Our Family Business by Vaisheshika Das, reading and relishing. Mm-hmm. And yeah, so many devotees that came from books. But I, in my case, I happen to be Prabhupada personally. The person Bhagavat.
Maharaj,
Sorry?
The friend that went along with you before.
Oh, yes. That was like quite disappointing. Although I've spoken to other devotees who've had similar experiences, but I thought this is it, you know? Because we were all sort of seekers. So I thought, you know, this is it. This is what we've been looking for. This is what, you know, this is the answer to our prayers and our search. But they didn't see it that way. And my cousin, very nice person, he's only 8 months younger than me, so about 1 year behind in school. But so he was going to Harvard, and so I thought, this is it. You know, I thought everyone who comes in touch with this is going to become a devotee because everything about it is so fantastic. So I invited him to the Sunday feast, and it's too sweet. It's like, it's just, they had a different experience. But there were some who took some interest. In fact, one of my good friends from college actually visited me in Juhu. And, but yeah, none of them became devotees. But they got benefit, no doubt. You know, they saw Prabhupada, they heard the kirtan. It'll pay off. It'll eventually pay off.
Question?
Yes.
Not question. They say that Janava, she's my best friend, and she got that Prabhupada drink and gave his silver cup to her to get, and she gave it to me, and I have the cup still, Prabhupada drinking cup.
Wow.
In my food.
You mean Janava from Alachua?
Alachua, Janava from Alachua.
Wow.
And then her queen daughter and my son, they all grew up together. Yeah.
Really? Yeah, she's very instrumental.
Yeah, she's a good artist also.
Yeah, she's.
Yeah, the book she made, the Jalabhuta. And I did all the pose, dancing pose, and she did the photograph and then painting it.
So that's really you. Yeah. Well, I don't know if I should say, because I don't know if it helps me in my Krishna consciousness to know this, but there's a picture of Mother Yashoda holding baby Krishna. And the person who posed for Mother Yashoda, I probably shouldn't say it because then you won't be able to see it the same anymore, but it was Hema Malini. Yeah.
Or the baby, the Mother Yashoda.
Yeah.
But they made it a little different. That's the way they do, no? As I told her also, don't put my name. If you don't stay, don't put my name. Because,
Oh, that's generally how artists do it. They get someone to.
They did
the, so then.
Yeah, poles are different. Poles has to do
that. Okay. Okay. So. Oh, did I say, are there more questions or comments?
I only have one question. How do you measure our spiritual advancement? Whether we are in the same place or whether we are advancing in some way? How do you measure that one and how do we know?
That's a very good question. Well, there are a number of answers that Srila Prabhupada has given, because sometimes
one doesn't perceive the difference immediately because Krishna consciousness is very subtle. You can be engaging in the same activities, but the difference is that it's for Krishna, but the activities can be the same. So Srila Prabhupada gave the example that someone gets on an airplane and they sit down, they do what they do on the ground. You know, they might drink some juice, read a magazine, talk to a friend. Nothing seems to be any different. But when they look out the window, they see, oh, like, come so far. So, if you look like what you were before, what you were doing before, you can see that you've come a long way, even though it's sort of subtle because you're generally speaking doing the same things. But sometimes you may feel it. I mean, that's like one verse, Bhakti Parashanu Bhavo Viraktiranyatracha, that one who engages in devotional service, in him or her, there's a development of satisfaction and detachment. Just like a person who's eating, they naturally, three things happen. They get strength, their hunger is reduced or removed, and they feel satisfaction. So if one is engaging in devotional service properly, at a certain stage one can feel these things. And that's why sometimes Srila Prabhupada would say that you don't, like, if you're eating, you don't have to take a certificate from the restaurant that you've eaten. You know you've eaten because you feel satisfied. You feel your hunger is gone. You feel you're getting strength. So that, that is possible, and it's nice to be able to perceive that. But whatever it is, you should continue. That's the main thing. And that's why one of the requirements for success is patience. It's in the Nectar of Instruction. Have you read many of Srila Prabhupada's books?
No, not many.
Any?
Yes, I just did. This is small, but few.
So I think that would help you. So one book called The Nectar of Instruction, it's quite small, only 11 verses, but very important. Good. So, utsaha nischaya daryat. These are like things that ensure one's success in devotional service. And daryat means patience. So even, you know, even if we feel that we're practicing but we're not getting the result, we should be patient and persevere. Good question. Yes, Shraddha. It all begins with Shraddha. Ado Shraddha. First comes Shraddha, then everything else follows.
So full of Shraddha.
About my books. Okay. Yes, that's a good idea. You can hand them to me. So this was the first one, watering the seed. And of course that phrase comes from Lord Chaitanya's instructions to Rupa Goswami that when you receive the seed of devotional service, you should water it.
By, how do you water the seed? Yes, by chanting and hearing about Krishna. So this is watering the seed. We got the seed from Srila Prabhupada, and then, well, he watered it. I mean, his chanting and hearing led to our chanting and hearing. And so yeah, there's a but there are quite a few exchanges between me and Srila Prabhupada, beginning from Boston and you know, up until the end. And yeah, some nice photos. This is something, I mean, I just opened this by chance, but this is something I was discussing with Ratutra Goswami yesterday. It comes here. So a newspaper reporter, newspaper editor from Mauritius met Srila Prabhupada, and although he was Hindu, you know, Mauritius is majority Hindu, but he had spent time in Russia and he was sort of a little communist type. So he sort of challenged that Arjuna heard the Bhagavad Gita, and after hearing the Bhagavad Gita, he said that he had understood the Bhagavad Gita and that he accepted it. But when Arjuna heard that his son Abhimanyu had been killed, he lamented, you know, very terribly. So isn't that ridiculous? So Prabhupada, you know, he could really know people's hearts. So when he said ridiculous, Prabhupada said, your question is ridiculous. You know, if someone is educated, he cannot, because he was saying Arjuna acted in a contrary way. So Prabhupada said, if someone is educated, he won't act in a contrary way. You know, so your question is ridiculous. And then he said that Krishna spoke the Bhagavad Gita to convince Arjuna to fight. So even though Arjuna lamented because his son was killed, Prabhupada said that's natural. Even though we know, in theory, nahanyate hanyamane sarire, but if some loved one dies, we will lament. He said, that's natural. Everyone does that. But even though he lamented, Arjuna didn't give up the fight. He still did his duty. He still fulfilled the purpose for which Krishna spoke the Gita to him. And that was his victory. So this is also very important for us to know as devotees, that we can have human feelings. It doesn't mean that we've fallen from the devotional standard, but we should continue in our devotional service. We should do our duty in Krishna consciousness no matter what. And that's the real conclusion. Okay, then this second, Many Moons. So this book is about, it's called Reflections on Departed Vaishnavas. It's about nine of Srila Prabhupada's followers who were very great devotees. And six of them were Prabhupada's direct disciples, beginning with Jayananda Prabhu, Gaur Govinda Swami, Tamal Krishna Goswami, Sridhar Swami, Bhakti Tirtha Swami, and Bhakti Swarup Damodar Swami. And then three were grand disciples. One was Kirtida Devi Dasi, who's a disciple of Tamal Krishna Goswami's, of Indian origin from South Africa. And one was Mother Archa Vigraha, was initiated by me. She was also from South Africa, but of European origin. And then a very sweet devotee named Abhiram Thakur. He was actually from Pakistan, and he was initiated by His Holiness Radhanath Swami. And he became, he was very extraordinary, because he was like ideal grihastha and then ideal vanaprastha. And he, after his wife passed away, he moved into the Chaupati temple, and he was like a, I don't know how to say, mother or father to all the brahmacharis there. Very. So this is my reflections on them, and also interviews with people about them. And yeah, it's quite nice. Very nice. And many moons. Of course, many moons, it means like a long time. Like, people say it's been many moons since we met. Like, one moon is like 1 month, so many moons. But the other significance, deeper significance, is that Prabhupada said that, he wasn't looking for many stars, like quoting that Chanakya Pandit, that one moon will illuminate the darkness of night more than thousands of stars. So Prabhupada was saying, he doesn't want like thousands of chief disciples, but just one moon. So that was like a big question, whether Prabhupada will get that moon. We didn't know. I mean, we weren't even maybe we couldn't say who was the moon. And then in one lecture, Srila Prabhupada said, I was thinking if I can get one moon, and now by Krishna's grace, I've got many moons. So, and then the last one, life's final exam. Who knows what life's final exam is?
Remember Krishna at the end of things.
Yeah. Yes, that's right. Yeah, there's a verse that, whatever sadhana and bhajan you do, that's all right, but everything will be tested at the time of death. So the first two books are written more for devotees. I mean, they're good for everyone, but this book is good for devotees, but it's written with a broader readership in mind. And it's something that everyone deals with, death. Not just their own, but the death of loved ones. And some people care for people who are dying. I mean, it really covers every aspect of it. And it has a number of articles, submissions, some by me and many by others also. So yeah, this is good. So ordinarily, each book sells for $20, but as a special, if you take a set of all three, it's only $50. And I think we have facility for credit cards.
Yeah.
We do?
Yeah.
Yeah. So, cash, check, credit card. And I will sign your copies. We also have a DVD. Why don't you hand me that DVD? Yeah. This is very special. This was actually a film shot on maybe 16 millimeter film. I mean, it was from the pre-digital era. And it was made for, I think, 1996, the 100 years since Prabhupada's birth. And it was a really a good film. But it was hardly shown. At one stage I wanted to make movies, but it was really well made. So when I left India, I thought, you know, it's like feeling separation from this film. It's about an hour long. So by then there was like home computer, personal computers and internet and everything. So I thought, well, you know, I'll go and I'll buy a DVD online, so I'll get to watch it. And there wasn't anything. And it turned out that the film had just remained in the cans, literally, the celluloid film in the cans. And so I took up this product. Yadubara Prabhu helped me to actually make it digital. And so there's this DVD. So yeah, it's very nice. And it's called A Lifetime in Preparation. It's based on the first volume of Srila Prabhupada Lilamrita. And it's all shot on location, all the original places. It's very artistic, very moving. Many devotees cry when they see it. So there's also this $10. Yeah. And then Bhagavad Gita as it is, all essential books of Srila Prabhupada. Thank you, Shraddha Devi. So does anyone know what comes next? Hare Krishna, Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna, Hare Hare. Hare Rama, Hare Rama, Rama Rama, Hare Hare. Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna, Hare Hare. Hare Rama, Hare Rama, Rama Rama, Hare Hare.
Thank you so much, Maharaj, for your wonderful class. And we are all feeling enlightened. And now the next part is obviously the Prasadam feast. So I request all the devotees to go to the garage area, which is from the back area. And please honor Prasad and...
I think we should have a little kirtan.
Yeah, sure.
Usually. We can even just Nisringa prayers.
Oh, sure.
Or were you going to... Yeah. And then if anyone wants to come up and meet me, I mean, I'll be here after prasad also. Oh, is someone volunteering?
No. It's normally kids sing, but that's... We don't need to sing.
Okay. Or I'll sing something else, very short, and then they can sing the Nisringa prayers. This is a verse that we used to sing in the Boston Temple, and it's a beautiful verse from Srimad Bhagavatam, and I don't know how it became a practice in the Boston Temple, but we used to sing it every day. And the meaning of the verse is, or I'll sing it first so you can hear the poetry, and then I'll explain it. And then I'll sing the Nisringa prayers. Sanasikaya Padam
Palavam Palavam Mahatpadam Punyaya Shomurale Bhavam Budhir Vasapadam Param Padam 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 Yadhi Padam Nakesham Samasritaye Pada Pavavam Padam Mahatpadam Punyaya Shomurale Bhavam Budhirvaksa Padam Param Padam 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 Yadhi Padam Natesham
So the meaning is that this material world is like an ocean of suffering. But for one who has taken shelter of the lotus feet of Krishna, who is known as Murari, that vast ocean shrinks and it becomes like a puddle of water in the hoof print of a calf. Although there's danger at every step, the devotee doesn't care for it, but he crosses right over. That's very, very sweet from a 10th canto, 14th chapter. So, yeah, I mean, even from the poetic point of view, I mean, some of the verses in the Bhagavatam, and even I've heard they're like mundane scholars, like they, like say the Gita Govinda by Jayadeva Goswami, there's no, they can't find any poetry like it anywhere. They're just leaving aside the philosophy or the bhakti, they're just the poetry. And that verse, amazing. Hare Krishna.